Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we appeal to heaven, we need to continue to learn, pray, and act. It is all about focusing on full compliance with the Constitution, which is why we read the Constitution every year in detail, diving into, you know, these aren't just GR's, you know, explaining. These explanations come from the ratification debates as well as Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And I say that we have to include that is because as the Constitution was read, and as they looked at it going into the debates, some of the things were just really accepted as common knowledge because that's really coming out of the convention, that was an accepted convention. When I say accepted convention, now I'll ask Sean because, welcome back, Sean. Hope you had a great weekend. And what I wanted to ask is, have you ever heard the use of the word convention that has nothing to do with a body of delegates meeting?
As far as just in a descriptive method, but...
Okay. So in engineering...
Like conventions of a certain practice.
There you go. So, correct. Method. I mean, you really have to think of expanding the earlier uses of that because conventions actually became adopted to, you know, consider these are standard practices. These are the normal conventions that we have applied in our development of software, in our development of blah, whatever. It's in medicine, what have you, right? It's the same thing with the convention of testing pharmaceutical products and how to do that, how to do blind studies. These become, you know, and this is where I will say continuous improvement becomes a real integral part in these conventions because, you know, as you realize, oh, you know, that blind study was problematic because we didn't account for these things. So over time, they just get better and better. The convention gets more widely accepted and more understood. And like I said, the outcome is far stronger or better. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so as we look at the Constitutional Convention, there were certain things regarding a natural-born president, right? And the president needed to be a natural-born citizen. How many ratification debates mentioned a natural-born citizen where they actually had a contention over that? Very little, very little. Why? Because the common knowledge of the people already accepted this understanding of why it was in there, because it was a part of natural law. And everybody understood not just natural law, the laws of nations as well. Everybody already understood, most all the people involved in politics understood the laws of nations. And actually, the laws of nations is actually cited in the Constitution. So there were these things that were, you know, in the Constitution where they just didn't get brought up. As a matter of fact, I'll give you another one. Bank. The word bank out of the ratification debates, if you do a global search out of all the ratification debates, I think you'll only find the word bank came up once or twice or three times. The word bank came up and it was only referring to a specific bank in its context. In other words, it wasn't basically making this insinuation or the fact that because the federal government had to tax and print and all these other, you know, not print, but coin money and these powers that were given to it regarding currency, that they had to create a bank. No, not at all. That was never mentioned. And it was clear that it wasn't necessary for the federal government because it was never brought up. And that was the standard convention of everybody just accepting that the federal government wouldn't need a bank. And it was Hamilton in 1792 with the Assumption Act, and then later on the Bank Act to basically say, well, it's implied No, it wasn't implied, nor is it a derivative of the powers. In other words, and we'll get into this when we're done with the Constitution, because we'll show how Jefferson and Madison clearly delineated how the Necessary and Proper Clause, you know, basically made it clear that what they were doing, they were meeting the Necessary and Proper Clause by creating the, you know, the currency, what have you, that they did not need a bank. The bank did not add anything other than a new bureaucracy and other problems in the governances. And what ended up happening, and I think that when we do the banks this year, we want to kind of look at the charter for that first bank. What was in that charter to see what they were able, what they were allowing that bank to do for them? Because I believe that the charter that Madison created for the second bank was trimmed down a lot, that they weren't creating products and they weren't trying to stimulate investments and those types of things, which, because Hamilton was trying to create a permanent bank. Okay, so we've kind of wrapped up Section 6, and we're now going into Section 7. And this one is basically pointing out that all bills with revenue, you know, originate in the House of Representatives. And so, you know, the Senate can amend and those types of things. So this really became a House control or a House matter, where the House basically said, hey, if we're going to spend money, it has to come from the House of Representatives. Now, this is where this concept of a bill to create the army, because it had to actually spend money, because it was raising money to raise the army, right? If they had to basically call forth the militia to do something, that had to basically induce a bill or a tax. So the bill raising revenue and calling forth the militia had to be included. And so that's one of the reasons why it's been my contention that the calling forth the militia was really controlled by the House, because they had to raise money to be able to do it. Because guess what? Where does the money come from when they actually pay the states to put these guys into service? It has to come from the federal government. So anyway, all right. So,
that's what I was going to say, yeah.
All right, so let's go ahead and read Section 7. It's just a few paragraphs, so this is the second one being kind of long, but let's read the very first one, and then we can dive into the next one. If you have any questions, go ahead. Go ahead.
All bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, but the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills. Every bill which shall have passed the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it become a law, be presented to the President of the United States. If he approve, he shall sign it, but if not, he shall return it, with his objections, to that House in which it shall have originated, who shall enter the objections at large on their journal and proceed to reconsider it. After such reconsideration, 2/3 of that House shall agree to pass the bill. It shall be sent together with the objections to the other House, by which it shall likewise be reconsidered, and if approved by 2/3 of that House, it shall become a law. But in all such cases, the votes of both houses shall be determined by yeas and nays, and the names of the persons voting for and against the bill shall be entered on the journal of each House respectively. If any bill shall not be returned by the President within 10 days, Sundays excepted, after it shall have been presented to him, the same shall be a law, in like manner as if he had signed it, unless the Congress, by their adjournment, prevent its return, in which case it shall not be a law.
Okay, so there's actually a lot of detail of what to do and how to do it, because there's this interplay, there's this interaction with the President, that the Congress actually had to get him to sign off on it. And he had a negative power over law. This is the only power regarding legislation that is not contained by Congress. Does the court have the ability to negate law? No. But they can tell Congress that the law that you've created because of this case that's come before us, because of this controversy, you have created a law that creates a conflict with another part of the Constitution, and you either need to change that law or nullify that law. So in other words, they can't get rid of it. They can't strike it. Now, John Marshall kind of said that they could, but technically they can't. What they would do is they would call it void and null and tell Congress to either get rid of it or change it and make it legitimate. In other words, fix the discrepancies. Right? So they don't have, the court doesn't have the authority to just, you know, erase law or create law. They have the ability to determine whether the law stands or creates a conflict, and then they have to tell, because they have no execution ability, right? They could go and make an appeal to the president to actually charge Congress with treason or what have you, but technically, where's treason tried?
In Congress.
Well, so actually it's tried in, but it's not tried in Congress. It is actually tried by the Supreme Court or the Chief Justice. It's kind of like an impeachment, but it's not handled by Congress itself. But the charges have to come from somebody. And so it comes from the executive. So the executive actually has the responsibility of basically identifying and charging somebody and arresting them, because he has the enforcement, right? The execution of the laws is under the commander-in-chief, who actually is commanding the militia as a federalized army. Just think, we don't have, just imagine in this new constitutional framework, we don't have any federal enforcement. Only when the militia is called up, they have the ability to do that. And so technically, any state has the ability to charge somebody with treason. And we'll get into this because it's just down the road a little bit. But we'll realize that when we look at treason, a state can charge somebody with treason, but if it's treason against the U.S. Constitution, the federal government has jurisdiction. If it's treason against the state constitution, then the state actually has jurisdiction. And there's no reason why you can't start charging your state legislature, who is actually creating laws outside the Constitution, with treason in your state. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I was misinterpreting Section 3 of Article 3.
Section 3 of the 14th Amendment with Article...
No, the 14th Amendment.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, so... Yeah, as we read through, the three branches actually have a symbiotic relationship. The president has, the enforcement. The court basically lays the judgment. They can't create law. That's where Congress either creates the law if it's in pursuant, right? If they make a law that is in pursuant to the calling forth of the militia, maintaining standards and those types of things, and a state fails to do that law that's within and a direct derivative of the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8, then they can be charged and a militia can be formed to go into that state and start arresting people for sedition and or treason, and the charge should be treason. But anyway, they like we said in the previous show last week on Friday, we talked about the Whiskey Rebellion and how 24 men were charged with treason and 2 were convicted for the Whiskey Rebellion. How many people should have been charged with treason during the pandemic and, the riots and all those types of things, like the autonomous zone in Seattle, and the fact that they let those people seize control over other people's property? Anyway. I don't want to. I could live in going through these things in a rat hole. But the point is that this right here, there's a lot of little detail of how things have to happen. This is the administrative process of the passing of a bill, but it points out at the very beginning that all bills for raising revenue, which means it should be a part of that bill if you're calling forth the militia, it needs to include the revenue to pay for that. just like when we declare war. How are they going to pay for that? Anyway, so the last paragraph is what we need to cover. Go ahead. It's the every order and resolution.
I'm sorry, I lost my
section.
Place.
It's okay. Section 7. It's obvious, and that's good.
Article 1, Section 7.
Yeah, yeah. So
I
hold
was
on.
Looking
hold
at Article 3, Section 3, where it talks about Congress has the power.
This is a good thing. Folks, when we're talking about the Constitution, I'm hoping at home, as we're reading this, that you do the same thing that Sean does, is you start actually looking at the other parts of the Constitution. Where do they talk about treason? I mean, if you're using a word program, you know, and just doing quick word search, or even Adobe and looking for the words, then it's just easy to do. And so we may get lost. Where were we? Okay, so that's where we have to kind of, okay, we're on that final paragraph of Section 7. Go ahead.
Back now, yeah. Every order, resolution, or vote to which the concurrence of the Senate and the House of Representatives may be necessary, except on a question of adjournment, shall be presented to the President of the United States, and before the same shall take effect, shall be approved by him, or being disapproved by him, shall be repassed by 2/3 of the Senate and House of Representatives according to the rules and limitations prescribed in the case of a bill.
This is pretty simple, straightforward, that they have the ability to pass things. I think the president has a responsibility in allowing or keeping Congress from completely adjourning. And we'll get into that in Article 3. Let's dive into Section 8. Now, we've talked about the preamble already. This very first line, as you're looking at it in the color-coded Constitution, we identify the very first part, or we call it the preamble, is this first paragraph that we read before we get into the actual enumerations. The enumerations start with 1 and go all the way, I think, through 17? Yeah, 17. So let's read the preamble.
The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. This was not modified by the 16th Amendment.
Yeah, so the key right here, it was not modified by the 16th Amendment. What we're reading here, this is the uniformity clause. Go ahead and read it now.
To pay debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States.
There you go. So in other words, if they're going to have a taxation, they have to be uniform or uniformly applied. Because it says duty, right? The duty tax was the apportionment tax. The 16th Amendment, what did it do? It changed the duty tax from an apportionment to income. But did the 16th Amendment say and give Congress the power to be able to actually choose how it wanted the percentages and the rates of taxation could be arbitrary so that they could actually punish, you know, people who made more money and instead of those who made less? Maybe they should have punished those who made less to incentivize them to actually produce more. Unless they had, and then create the caveats like they do. Oh, well, if you're sick, or if you're, you know, disabled, you're, you know, elderly, what have you, then, okay, you know, those don't apply. But if you're a healthy human being, you better be contributing. Now, but that would require language in the amendment to actually violate that non-uniformity. In other words, they could only create a flat tax in income, that 5%, 10%, whatever it's going to be. It had to be applied to everybody. And in so doing, this is the divine hand of providence ensuring that they couldn't actually become manipulators and judgers of society to say, you're making too much money, we're going to punish you. And we'll actually get into this in Article 1, Section 9, how the government cannot create preferences or favors towards one group or another. And that concept of preferences and giving favors or advantages to one class or group of people or one state or port or what have you is applicable. It was the spirit of the Constitution that this federal government was going to be blind and impartial. It was literally just going to be ensuring that everybody, all the states, were being treated equally. That was the spirit of the Constitution. Not to allow the federal government to start creating this concept of, well, we're going to pick the winners and choose winners and losers, and we're going to start punishing people. And as they started punishing people, you know, like the people making a lot of money, they also created real favors because their most favored people were the corporate, you know, all these people that were ultra rich. So ultimately, the people that were unprotected, that had no voice with the federal government, was what? The middle class. And that middle class was a very large group. And so, you know, the doctors started getting together, creating their own lobbies to protect them, you know, and, you know, sales or these other people that had this, not doctors, but just lawyers. These other people that were in the professions that were making, you know, more money than everybody else in the middle class, but they just weren't that opulent, right? They weren't making themselves world kings like, you know, Bill Gates and Soros and Buffett and all these other people. So the point is that they actually started creating within their execution of the laws unconstitutionally by the IRS, because it was supposed to be done by the militia. But the execution of the laws, they started changing, creating more favors towards those who had money power collectively as a small group of high wage earners or the upper middle class. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. So, okay. I just want to be really clear how this uniformity clause was not just an arbitrary thing. It was the spirit, this whole concept that this federal government was not to be a dominator and or a ruler, winner maker, loser maker, anything like that. So now we'll get actually into the laws, or I should say the powers. Now, when it says the power to do something, then this is it. And if you want to, you know, start loaning money, because the concept here, because the very first thing you're going to read is that Congress shall have the power. So the one thing that we read at the beginning of all of these lines is the Congress shall have the power, and then the two is repeated down here, to borrow money on the credit of the United States. So they should have the power to do that. Now, the reason that they have the power, because they kind of explain that, is to be able to do these following things. So the preamble basically says we're going to do this. So it repeats the power to create debt, that they have the good faith and credit of the United States, to borrow money on the credit of the United States. And then they get into commerce. They're going to have the ability to regulate commerce. So I'll let you do that. Go ahead, because it's a good habit to get into. The Congress shall have the power. Go ahead.
The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises.
Okay, so now let's read number two of the enumerations, because we already did that.
Okay.
Right? So that was we already did the preamble. So what you do is you read the Congress shall have the power, and then you start with two, to regulate. So Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce. So
with foreign nations, mm-hmm, and among the several states and with the Indian tribes.
Okay, so there's three things that they're being granted power here. Very specific power. They're very different. That they have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Regulate commerce with the Indian tribes. Regulate commerce with the foreign nations. Is it regulate commerce with the several states or among the several states? And so we're going into break here. Let's think about that. So when we go into break, let's actually look at what is the difference in language with and among, because it is very stark, folks, very stark. So when we come back, we'll dive into this one clause, because
This clause has been completely redefined by the federal government because they tell you they can regulate to the nth degree any form of commerce within the states. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as we dive into each of these powers, how the language goes is very specific. Because remember, we were talking about their ability to make laws regarding the enumerations. They have to be a derivative of that language and or what is being enumerated, what is being delegated in that one line. Now, in the line above, it says Congress have the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Does it imply, or is there any mention as a derivative of the language of that, that they shall make a bank and be able to create products with that bank to make money?
No.
Okay. So it is not within the pursuance of that line. It is an implication that has been inserted by somebody that says, I think we can imply that we can create a bank here. Implications were never laid out as, oh yeah, we can imply anything. As a matter of fact, the Constitution was constantly justified when we went through the ratification debates. No. It has to be a derivative of that very specific power, which is why the word bank was never brought up. It was only that the Congress shall have the power to borrow money. So who's borrowing the money? Congress. There you go. So Congress is the bank. They're not a bank. Does that make sense? They're not creating a bank. They are the one that is, they're kind of like the borrower. They are the borrower. Congress is the borrower. We're going to call them Congress and that's it. So they have the power to borrow money and they do that with bills. And the execution, I should say, of ensuring that that's done properly is done by the executive, which falls under the Department of Treasury, Department of State, so forth and so on. So anyway, he's right. Where does the debt come from? Is it coming from ourselves? We're borrowing from ourselves? Probably not. We're going to be borrowing from somebody that actually has cash, has gold, and they're going to give us gold. Or they'll give us credit and, you know, goods and what have you in a commodity like gunpowder, guns, ships, whatever. But the point is that it is a derivative. What they can do is a derivative of that particular language. So let's look at the regulation of commerce. So Congress has the ability to regulate commerce with foreign nations. Does that mean that Congress on its own sets the tone and the tenor and or the relationship with a foreign nation?
Definitely.
No. Actually, no. Actually, that is the president's responsibility. When we get to Article 2, the president is the one that establishes the emissaries. Does it say Congress shall have the emissary responsibility? No. Now, the Senate...
Regulating commerce would kind of affect that, though, wouldn't it?
Yes. Okay. So what happens is the president determines who we're going to actually make trade with, not Congress. Does that make sense?
I do.
So
it's hard to think about that. I hate to go off on a thing, but It's hard to think about how they would do things back then. You would think that the merchants would be the ones that would initiate commerce according to supply and demand.
So right now, we're only looking at the powers of Congress because it all is a part of Article 1. When we get to Article 2, now we're going to focus on those roles, responsibilities, and if you want to call them powers, and or, you know, these things that the president has these responsibilities to do. He's the one that actually establishes the foreign relations. He can withdraw foreign relations with any nation, can't he? He can call his emissaries out. He can tell every United States citizen, you're on your own. You know, if you're there, you know, we can't help you. Right. He has that authority. And so that means that if Congress is trying to undermine him and that authority because they want to do trade, then that would create a real conflict within the Constitution. And clearly the president has that responsibility. That's in Article 2. And so the same thing. So how are trade agreements done? So when we look at the very first presidency, George Washington, it was his policy when he started establishing the Treasury and the State Department, and this was before Hamilton, so this was before Jefferson. So here's a little backstory. We don't get into this, but I like telling the story. Sorry about that. When the secretaries were being seated in the new federal government, well, Jefferson had just, he was on his way back from France. And he wanted to change his clothes. He kind of wanted to take some downtime. So he didn't show up as the Secretary of State immediately. Now, Hamilton, being a, I'll just say an opportunist or a guy that wants to, help him out. So Hamilton decided what the responsibilities of the Treasury Department would be and what the responsibilities of the State Department would be. And so when Jefferson finally showed up, he realized that some things that should have been a State Department responsibility was sitting over there with Hamilton, in Hamilton's Treasury Department. And Jefferson goes, what the heck happened here? And everybody goes, well, we needed to set things up, and so we were just trying to line things out. And I think over time, some of that stuff got peeled back and over to the State Department. But Hamilton already kind of, sent a shot across the bow. I'm a very aggressive person, and, I'm going to be getting in everybody's knickers. And at that point in time, Thomas Jefferson already had this caution about him with Hamilton. He didn't know just how devious this man was until he actually defied him and stabbed him in the back. And that after that point in time, Thomas Jefferson referred to him as the creature. So anyway, when Washington was basically giving Hamilton this charge of, his policy, Washington wanted to have a neutral policy. Why did Washington want to have a neutral policy? Well, it was very easy. As the president of the United States, he did not want to get us into war, something we just ended just recently, that we're still kind of, in hock for, paying for, and, the cost of lives, all of these things. It's just, we don't want to repeat that. We don't want to live in that world. So he tried to create a very neutral government. The problem was, he was inheriting a bad treaty that both the United States and Britain were violating. Britain was impressing and seizing our ships and impressing the sailors and taking them and, the goods, all that. So, we weren't happy about that. We didn't give Britain, or I should say the people and Britain, the money for what we confiscated from the loyalists that we kicked out, the 100,000 people, all their property and everything we took from them. Britain had in the treaty, we were going to pay them back. And we didn't do that. So, both sides were violating the treaty. So at that point in time, when we finally created the Constitution, Washington kind of inherited a mess. You see what I'm saying? And so that mess actually forced him to try to play clean, nice guy going forward in the first 8 years, which really required this, you know, this, I'll just say, neutrality and playing nice with everybody. You know, he already realized that we were given a sour bill because we had a lot of debt that Continental Congress was unable to pay, right? So, yeah, go ahead, Sean. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just unmuting. I had a background noise.
Oh, okay, so that's okay. I see you have your hand up, so I thought maybe you wanted to say something.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. That was okay. Before when we were getting close to the break, I was trying to...
Yeah, that's okay. I apologize. I missed that. As a matter of fact, the best thing to do is just interrupt me. Hey, big mouth, or, you know, whatever. I know you wouldn't say that, and I probably wouldn't say that either. But anyway, by all means, just say, hey, we're running out of time. Because I'm always quick to shut up, because I know that, you know, I'm sucking up all the air, and I can use some fresh air for myself. Anyway, so the point is, Washington's hands were really tied. He inherited a mess. As a matter of fact, he inherited bad treaties with the Indians. There were a lot of problems under this new government that the United States was inheriting. Does that make sense? Because everybody looks at we being the source of all of the problems. Actually, we inherited most all of the problems that everybody complains about. We inherited, with the Constitution, we maintained slavery. That's something we inherited in the Declaration of Independence. We were clear that that was inflicted upon us by the king and by the monarchy. Therefore, when we, you know, looked at moving forward, that's why the Constitutional Convention, we covered this in detail. They really wanted to end it. There was three states that said, no, we can't end it. And it was for three states that they compromised. It was, you know, a tragic compromise. Nevertheless, what we were walking into under this Constitution, it's amazing that the Constitution was so well done that in dealing with all of these messes that we had to inherit, it gave us the ability to work through them in the best manners possible. So it really led more towards the individual presidents and their presidencies that allowed that to happen. Like with the Indian treaties and so forth, it wasn't until Jefferson where our relations with Indians really improved. The Indians actually started really embracing being citizens of the United States and dealing in commerce with us. The Cherokee Nation became so successful in the South. They became so successful in the South that by the 1820s, they had their own published, it was the first published paper in the area, the Cherokee, and they were dominating in commerce. They were just cleaning up because they were entrepreneurial, they were energetic, where the typical people in those states in that area were kind of lazy. It was because everything else was being done by slaves. And so it was when the slave owners started complaining, hey, why are we competing with Indians? And that's when they went to Jackson, because Jackson had a sympathetic ear and said, you got to get rid of these Indians. And that's when the atrocities and violations of the Constitution occurred, because Jackson didn't have the power to do what he did. But my point is that we were really making things right. We were making inroads, and there was this inclusion and incorporation of Indians up until that point in time. And actually, if you kind of look at the different cycles of American, the federal government with Indian tribes, there have been these cycles where we've had bad players that have done really bad things. Long story short, Washington was our first president. He was the first one that started creating the emissaries and basically inheriting the emissaries that Continental Congress had. So he had the ability to start actually pulling, and it was Jefferson's call as his principal secretary of state. It was Jefferson's call that said we should stop trading with England. And Washington didn't want to do that. And as a matter of fact, it created this huge flack in his administration, and the words Francophile and Anglophile became common words, you know, which was Jefferson was supporting French and saying we should have favorable trade with them and have limited trade, if any trade, with Britain. And so Hamilton was in favor of Britain and, you know, forgiving them and trying to, you know, even though they were violating the treaty. So when you look at all of these things, I think Washington wasn't out of his league. I think he was really trying to lead. He had two very dynamic loggerheads going at it, if you know what I mean. Between Jefferson and Hamilton. So forgive me for going through this long diatribe. I'm just trying to help everybody understand that this regulation of commerce and how it started, Congress basically was the one, because it was set, the tone was set by Washington. We want to have free trade. We want to minimize our imposts. Imposts really started becoming more of the flavor of America later on because we didn't even have a navy to defend ourselves. And these other nations, hey, we're taking offense that you're taxing us on what we're selling you. Right? So, you know, Washington was doing everything he could to try to avoid any type of foreign aggression. And we were getting, you know, harassed by the Ottoman Empire from in the Mediterranean and so forth. And when Jefferson inherited that, he basically sent the Marines. He inherited the Marines because of Adams. So as we look at the presidents and how everything kind of evolved, it's interesting that these different personalities kind of put us on the right path based on the Constitution where those powers were delegated. So let's go into the third power being delegated in Article 1, Section 8. See, this is why going through Article 1, Section 8 takes some time to try to explain how this was, what it was, and how they kind of grew into this or what they did to set the precedents and how we've deviated severely from that. So let's go ahead into this next one. Go ahead.
The Congress shall have power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States.
Okay, so there's two parts to this, and it's all about having uniform. So why was Congress, let me ask you this question, why was Congress given this power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization? Where was the naturalization occurring currently? At the time of the Constitution being drafted and ratified, who was naturalizing the citizens?
The states, right?
There you go. The states were doing it. And so the states actually managed their own importation of people, and the states managed the immigration. That's why it does not say to regulate immigration and establish. There's no mention of immigration here, right? Okay, that means that Congress and the federal government had no authority. As a matter of fact, had the Constitution given the federal government the ability to regulate who was going to immigrate into the states would have said, we consider that a threat to our sovereignty. Nobody knows what we need better than us, and we will import or allow immigrants from the nations we need. We're not going to let you tell us that we have to take these, you know, whatever, these indolence or these, you know, plagued, you know, health plague problems or what have you. And it wasn't until the federal government started assuming this when, you know, because we're being overran by immigrants, because the states weren't managing it. It was another crisis created by the states so the federal government could assume it unconstitutionally. And when they did, and they started managing these ports of entry like, you know, Staten Island and so forth, or Staten Island, I mean, sorry. As we look at, you know, what they were doing, then we ended up getting the Statue of Liberty. Give us your poor, give us your weak, because that was the new policy. You know, we're going to take anybody and everybody. That was the new federal policy when the states before, they wanted people that were going to be able to come in and contribute. And the states literally started allowing themselves to be overran. So you see how it happened, right? That actually happened right after the Civil War when it really got out of hand. That's when the first established federal regulations on immigration actually was the first written after the Civil War. So, okay, and the uniform laws on bankruptcies, right? They have this responsibility that's right there, and uniform laws on the subjects of bankruptcies through the United States.
Can I interject here?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to see if you could give me a definition of what exactly naturalization meant.
It is the under the laws of nations, naturalization is the process of a person who has citizenship under the subject of another nation to actually abjure their citizenship and become a citizen under the United States. And so in the very beginning, the United States did not allow dual citizenship. And when you look at the oath of a citizen, it does not allow dual citizenship. The only dual citizenship that's allowed are U.S. citizens are allowed to travel and actually become citizens abroad and maintain their citizenship with the United States. So in other words, naturalized or natural-born citizens are granted the ability to have, dual citizenship. Does that make sense? And is that answering your question?
Kind of on both counts.
Okay. All right. So it was a process of what it took for a person to transfer their, them being subject to a different state or different nation, potent, sovereign, laws, whatever, and then become a subject to the laws of the state as well as the U.S. government. Not a subject of the government, but subject to the laws. Right. And jurisdiction, right. Okay.
So then you were under the jurisdiction of, correct?
Yes, correct. Mm-hmm. That's why the under the jurisdiction thereof, because were slaves not under the jurisdiction of the federal government? Yeah, they were, because they actually had representation. 3/5 of a slave had representation. Right. So it's the same thing with Indians on an Indian reservation. Is that Indian reservation or the federal territories or what have you, is that not under the jurisdiction of the federal government?
Yes, it is.
There you go. So how is it that Indians were not under the jurisdiction? That's why they became citizens. Everybody that was they were born in the territories, they had been born here. And you got to remember that the importation of the slaves and the importation of Indians just was not occurring. So all Indians and all black slaves in America had generational roots that they were born here under the jurisdiction of the United States, which means that the 14th Amendment granted them citizenship. Now, the Indians weren't told that. And actually, there were members of Congress and the federal government that actually ruined what the intent was. And they redefined it, says, "Nah, we're not including you."
Right. I think that's a big deal because, especially right now and in recent times with all the immigration issues that we've been dealing with and how they've just completely thrown everything out and just doing whatever they feel like doing for their political purposes, to understand what naturalization actually means. Like when they were flying, Biden was flying plane loads of illegal aliens to different states in the middle of the night from the border camps where they were coming in at.
Right.
I mean, that's just crazy.
Right. And what he was doing, because the law demands that they be repelled. What they did was they all played, remember when you were a kid and you were dealing with this, somebody was, we were playing a game, right? And everybody kind of knew the game of hide and seek. And then all of a sudden, somebody said, "Well, I'm wearing this kind of coat. That means I can do this or that." In other words, they're changing the rules. In other words, there was a childish term for that. Oh, you're making it up as you go along. Right? That's exactly what the courts, the federal government, the executive, and Congress have been doing. They've been redefining what an invader is. An invader is a person who came here without authorization to be an immigrant, or without authorization from the state to actually go there and start their path to becoming a citizen. In other words, you have to have authority before you come here from the state to be, when you get here, you're going to be on the path of becoming a citizen. That's the whole intent of an immigrant. Now, you can come and visit If you have a passport and you come through a port of entry, that means you're here as a visitor, you know, or for education. There's different reasons why people come here, but they have to be legitimate, legal reasons. People that come across the border to get here to do migrant worker stuff, they actually have a process for that, to come across the border legitimately as a migrant worker. But they've been making it up and they've been changing it all to make sure that they just make it easier to get people in here and hide them so that they actually put a greater strain on our system. In other words, this is literally an insurrection against the Constitution.
Absolutely. When you toss in the part about apportionment, and that's what they're using these people for, is to pad the numbers or, you know, cheat on apportionment by including them as part of the voting public, it's just ridiculous.
And so technically, when we get into the 14th Amendment, Section 2 of the 14th Amendment identifies that only citizens are to be allowed and are to be allowed to vote. Non-citizens cannot vote. The apportionment only applies to citizens. Apportionment for representation only applies to citizens. Anyway, so let's go to the next one.
To coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures.
Okay, so they have the responsibility of coining money. And as a matter of fact, later on we find out that the money must be in gold and or silver coin, because the states are restricted to allowing anything other than that being used as the legal payment for the tender of debt. And regulating the value thereof of our coin as well as the foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. In other words, create a standard amongst all the nations. Are we going with meters? Are we going with feet? Well, we decided to go with feet. Until later on, they decided to go to meters. And the state said, we're not going to go to that. We're not doing that. And that's why Congress passed the law that we would go to, you know, the metric system instead of the English foot and pounds and so forth. And therefore, they created a law that they could fix the standards and weights and measures, but the states just didn't go along with it because they didn't like the European model versus and giving up what they had been doing, because it became a burden on manufacturing and everything else to start changing everything. And they said no. And so technically, I think that should have been established what the standards and weights and measures were to be, and then that was it. So it was a one-time thing. And I believe that when we really look at when Congress passed that, it was a globalist effort to start expanding the corporate, you know, globalism into America. Because around the same time, and we're out of time now. So when we come back, I will dive into the corporations and so forth, because that kind of lends into why they actually created that law. I'll try to look it up so that we can give you the facts on when Congress actually decided to make this major change. But more importantly, you know, how corporations were actually being ushered in. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract.
And with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.